So today's topic is on Dijon. It's the 10-year anniversary, as you already know. And Steve Sverdlow, you are an expert on what's been happening in Uzbekistan for many, many years. And the first question I want to ask you is, could you explain what the rights situation was like in Uzbekistan prior to May 2005 when Andijan happened?
Well, Uzbekistan had a very abysmal, one could say, human rights record even before Andijan. The government had systematically eliminated the political opposition. It had gone after human rights defenders. And starting in about 1998, with the passage of one of the world's most restrictive laws on religion, the government imprisoned, tortured, arbitrarily detained thousands of what we refer to as independent Muslims and sentenced them to very lengthy terms. Independent Muslims are people that practice their belief or their religion outside of the strict state controls that the Uzbek authorities established, which could mean praying in your home. It could mean carrying an unauthorized piece of literature, such as the Quran, or wearing a beard or a hijab in the wrong place. And so really you had a very serious human rights situation in Uzbekistan. But at the same time, there was some momentum, even on the part of the government, a few years before Andijan, where one could see that Tashkent was at specific moments maybe looking for areas that it could engage on human rights issues. So in 2002, for example, they did allow the one and only, the last visit by a UN human rights expert, the Special Rapporteur on Torture, who was allowed to visit Uzbekistan and do a comprehensive examination of the situation regarding torture and the criminal justice system. And there was also, in 2002, the registration, also the one and only, a registration of an NGO, an independent human rights group called Ezgulik. So there were a few bright spots, one could say, amidst an otherwise very bleak human rights picture, which then, of course, really plummeted on May 13, 2005.
May 13, 2005, it was a watershed moment for Uzbekistan in a lot of ways. And before we go specifically to talking about Andijan, I was wondering if you could carry us through the rights situation in Uzbekistan since May 13, 2005. You've already explained to us that the rights situation was poor prior to the events in Andijan. Since that happened, how would you characterize the progress or lack thereof in the rights situation in Uzbekistan?
The human rights picture in Uzbekistan is atrocious across a wide spectrum of violations. We already touched on torture. Torture in Uzbekistan has been observed as endemic, systematic. In fact, the Committee Against Torture in the United Nations in 2013 even stated that torture was encouraged amongst law enforcement officers in Uzbekistan. That's really serious. In fact, just on torture, recently the government of Norway actually banned returning anyone to Uzbekistan under any circumstances because of concerns that anyone that was sent back could be tortured even upon their arrival to the international airport in Tashkent. And so you actually have seen the torture situation remain really at the top of the list of concerns for us, for other organizations. Amnesty International just put out a report about this year on torture. So torture continues to be a major concern. In addition to that, freedom of expression in Uzbekistan is in a dire state. No political opposition, not a single independent newspaper allowed to function, or independent journalism as such. All international media have been banned. Of course, Radio Free Europe and the BBC, Deutsche Welle, all forced to leave after Andijan. In terms of the cotton sector, we see still, despite some positive signs in terms of child labor, we see still, the Uzbek government acting as the trafficker in chief, which is really unique in the world in terms of mobilizing millions of its citizens to pick cotton from September to November in conditions that really approximate modern slavery. Of course, freedom of religion is still incredibly restrictive in that regard. And then, of course, the internet completely censored in a totalitarian way. And then you combine that overall atrocious human rights record with a really defiant attitude on the part of the government with regard to playing by basic international rules on human rights. So, for example, I mentioned that there's only been one and only visit by a UN human rights expert to Uzbekistan, and that occurred in 2002. Uzbekistan now, 13 years later, has not allowed a single expert into the country to look into issues such as women's rights, forced labor, the independence of the judiciary, the situation for human rights defenders. There are actually 13 human rights experts from the UN, not from Human Rights Watch, not journalists, but from the UN, who have been denied access, which puts Uzbekistan in a category really of its own. I think perhaps only Zimbabwe and Venezuela, if I'm not mistaken, have denied more UN experts the access to the country than Uzbekistan, and for as long a period of time. So you see an Uzbek government in the last 10 years which has become really defiant, in a way proudly defiant, of its bad human rights record. And I think that recipe is really dangerous. It's really caused a lot of suffering for the millions of people in Uzbekistan, but it's also dangerous for the international community.
To the best of your knowledge, has the Uzbek government ever acknowledged any fault for what happened in Andijan or responded to any of the criticism for its handling of the crisis?
Well, the Uzbek government officially admits to a death toll of 187 victims killed on that day. And the government, in its official responses, in its public statements, attributes all those deaths allegedly to the armed gunmen they allege orchestrated and perpetrated all the violence. Of course, armed gunmen that the government say were attempting to establish an Islamic caliphate. Of course, our research and the research of local human rights defenders and others that have looked at Andijan found no evidence that day in the central square, Babur Square of Andijan, that the protesters were pursuing that agenda of establishing the Islamic caliphate. In fact, our research showed that while, of course, there were armed elements in the crowd and there were events that led up to the mass protest on May 13th in which crimes were committed, regardless of that, the massive protest that occurred on May 13th, which included thousands of residents of Andijan, was really focused on citizens airing their grievances about corruption, poverty, and human rights abuses, and they actually expected that Uzbek officials, maybe even Karimov himself, would address the crowd that day. The Uzbek government really refuses to get into any of all this, of course, including the actual violence that ensued, and has refused to allow an international investigation into those events from the beginning until now.
The next question is actually, there's two parts to this, so I'll give them both. How is the subject treated inside Uzbekistan, and do state officials or state media even bring the subject up?
It was unexpected for observers like myself that Andijan would even be referred to or mentioned inside Uzbekistan. We often see total censorship on most sensitive topics in Uzbek society on the Uzbek state-sponsored, state-controlled media. But interestingly, and I think not by coincidence, a film was released recently, which is called Sapkin in Uzbek, which translates as traitor. And this film, which comes out of Tashkent's fairly well-subsidized, Hollywood-type film industry, was packed with really important stars of Uzbekistan's film industry, tries to loosely tell the story of Andijan. This film was released sometime in the last few months. And as I said, loosely based on Andijan, the film attempts to explore disturbances in a city, which should sort of remind people of Andijan, violence which is committed by Islamic extremists who are financed, controlled, and supported by outside governments, the implication being Western governments. And there are a lot of statements in this movie made by security officers who are very heroically portrayed that the international media and NGOs are out to get Uzbekistan, and that any sort of mistakes, so-called mistakes in the arrest or the detention of Islamic extremists, could result in the NGOs and the international media tarnishing Uzbekistan's reputation and really taking it down. And it's very interesting that the title of the film, Traitor, sort of encapsulates a really strong strain in Uzbek state-sponsored culture right now, which is this idea that there are enemies among us, that citizens can be led astray, and that it's very important that everyone remain diligent, listen to the government, don't really take in foreign influences, don't ask questions, don't get in somehow associated with those outside governments, those Westerners, those media, those NGOs, because they could lead you astray and they could lead to catastrophe. And I think it's really interesting. The film does not, of course, mention that there were massive deaths on May 13th, 2005, It does not get into that, of course, predictably. But it's interesting that the government does seem to be anticipating this 10th anniversary. It does want to provide its own narrative. And again, it's a quite strident, assertive narrative that Andijan for us is closed, and any violence that was committed or harm that was done by outsiders, not by us.
And the last question, this comes from our Uzbek service. Krom Yuldashev was the alleged leader of this alleged group, Akromiya, who the Uzbek government says is at the center of all this violence in Andijan. What happened to him, and what happened to the other 22 businessmen who were detained, and actually their detention sparked the initial peaceful protest?
Again, it's very important that we remember those that are imprisoned as a result of the Andijan events, and those that were put in prison like Akram Yuldashev way before the Andijan events, because I just have to mention that we think there are several hundred, maybe around 300 or so individuals that were sentenced in show trials after Andijan, in the wake of Andijan, where we had strong evidence and suggestions of torture. Of course, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights paid special attention to those trials and called for due process rights to be ensured, and there's been no access to those prisoners, especially since the International Committee of the Red Cross was forced to discontinue its visitation of all detainees and prisoners across Uzbekistan. Akram Yuldashev is a really important case for us to think of on this anniversary. Why? Because, of course, he was alleged by the Uzbek government to be a mastermind of these events, albeit from sitting inside a jail cell since 1999, when he had been imprisoned in the earlier wave of politically motivated arrests that the Uzbek government unleashed after the February 1999 bombings in Tashkent. He was imprisoned in a wave that included Mohammed Bekjanov, the world's longest imprisoned journalist, and others. But Akram Yuldashev is a prisoner, a political prisoner. We consider him to be a political prisoner, whose case that Human Rights Watch raised with the Uzbek government very recently, in September 2014, when we released a report about political prisoners in Uzbekistan. We specifically wrote to the government and we asked them to share the whereabouts of Akram Yuldashev and his health conditions. We had indications from his family that resides in the United States. Some of them were fled and resettled as refugees after Andijan, that he had been tortured. And quite disturbingly, the Uzbek government, while it responded about the whereabouts and conditions of other prisoners, it did not even acknowledge holding Akram Yuldashev. And his family, in fact, hasn't received any information about where he's located or the condition he's in for at least 5 years. And this constitutes a serious crime under international law. It constitutes what we call a disappearance, an enforced disappearance. The government has a responsibility to acknowledge holding him and the conditions that he's in. So, of course, this can lead to all sorts of presumptions about what's happened to him. We don't know whether he's alive or dead, but it's a very serious situation, and we're calling on the government not only to release him, but, of course, initially to identify where he is. That's the absolute least that they can do. The other businessmen, many of them were resettled to other countries that agreed to take Andijan refugees, and others we haven't been able to keep track of all of those cases, but we're trying to follow as closely as we can the fate of everyone connected to those events, but it's very difficult given the fear factor that is so strong among that community.